Hello and welcome. It is Eric Erickson here this Tuesday. I feel obligated to keep telling us what day it is, just in case you don't know. It is 6 after the hour. The phone number here is 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. I suspect I should probably get into the call screening program here just so I can answer your phone calls. Should any of you dare call, you are allowed to. We obviously have to get into the Al-Qaeda situation. We haven't heard Al-Qaeda in a while. We also need to get into the hydroxychloroquine situation with the president. But before we do any of that, some sad news this morning. Ravi Zacharias has passed. Let me read you some of his obituary from his ministry outlet. When Ravi Zacharias was a cricket-loving boy on the streets of India, his mother called him to meet the local sari seller turned palm reader. "Looking at your future, Ravi Baba, you will not travel far or very much in your life," he declared. "That's what the lines on your hand tell me. There is no future for you abroad." By the time a 37-year-old Zacharias preached at the invitation of Billy Graham to the inaugural International Conference for Itinerant Evangelists in Amsterdam in 1983, he was on his way to becoming one of the foremost defenders of Christianity's intellectual credibility. A year later, he founded Ravi Zacharias International Ministries with the mission of helping the thinker believe and the believer think. In the time between the sari seller's prediction and the founding of RZIM, Zacharias had immigrated to Canada, taken the gospel across North America, preached with military prisoners in Vietnam, and ministered to students in Cambodia on the brink of collapse. He had also undertaken a gospel preaching trip as a newly licensed minister with the Christian and Missionary Alliance, along with his wife Margie and eldest daughter Sarah. The trip started in England, worked eastward through Europe and the Middle East, and finished on the Pacific Rim. All in all, that year, Zacharias preached nearly 600 times in over a dozen countries. It was the culmination of a remarkable transformation set in motion with Zacharias recovering in a Delhi hospital from a suicide attempt at age 17, was read the words of Jesus recorded in the Bible by the Apostle John, "Because I live, you also will live." In response, Zacharias surrendered his life to Christ and offered up a prayer that if he emerged from the hospital, he would leave no stone unturned in his pursuit of truth. Once Zacharias found the truth of the gospel, his passion for sharing it burned bright until the very end. Even as he returned home from the hospital in Texas, where he had been undergoing chemotherapy, Zacharias was sharing the hope of Jesus to the three nurses who tucked him into his transport. Frederick Anthony Ravi Kumar Zacharias was born in Madras, now Chennai, in 1946, in the shadow of the resting place of the Apostle Thomas, known to the world as the Doubter. But to Zacharias is the great questioner. Zacharias' affinity for Thomas meant he was always more interested in the questioner than the question itself. His mother, Isabella, was a teacher. His father, Oscar, who was studying labor relations at the University of Nottingham in England when Zacharias was born, rose to the ranks of the Indian Civil Service throughout Zacharias' adolescence. An unremarkable student, Zacharias was more interested in cricket than books until his encounter with the gospel in that hospital bed. Nevertheless, a bold, radical faith ran in his genes. In the Indian state of Kerala, his paternal great-grandfather and grandfather produced the 20th century's first Malayalam English dictionary. The dictionary served as the cornerstone of the first Malayalam translation of the Bible. Further back, Zacharias' great-great-great-grandmother shocked her Nambuduri family, the highest caste of the Hindu priesthood, by converting to Christianity. With conversion came a new surname, Zacharias, and a new path that started her descendants on a road to Christian faith. Rest in peace, Ravi Zacharias. We were actually supposed to get together. He and his wife wanted to take me and my wife to dinner, and it never worked out. And we'll meet again one day. But what a fantastic man. Smeared several years ago, smeared by someone claiming he had engaged in inappropriate relationships. No truth to the matter, but it was magnified and blown up by a liberal press out to get the man. What a fantastic person. What a great, great man who led so many people to Christ. Now, I did not expect to start the show with that today, but my goodness. I just, if you've never seen or read, read The Real Face of Atheism, that is Ravi Zacharias's a book. I see my friend Andrew Walker mentioning it this morning. Zacharias was just a wonderful human being who loved the Lord, and he will deeply, deeply, dearly be missed by a lot of us who he ministered to knowingly or unknowingly over the years. Just a good, good man. Now, we do need to move on to the headlines of the day, and I will take your phone calls, 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. The program this morning is sponsored by First Liberty Building and Loan in Noonan. If you need help getting into the PPP program, I do highly encourage you to reach out to First Liberty Building and Loan. The reason why the Frost family has been helping small and mid-sized businesses since the early 1990s, it is their specialty. They don't work directly with individuals. They work with businesses. And if your business needs access to capital and needs to grow, they can help you. But more importantly, if your business needs to get into the PPP program, they can help you. There is still money available in the program, and First Liberty is willing to help you. What you do is you go to firstlibertyga.com. Firstlibertyga.com is their website. Click on the Apply Now button, fill out your paperwork there, and they will get it processed. The one thing that the Frost family who runs First Liberty tells me is that you do need to have your payroll in order. Make sure that your forms are available, your federal quarterly filings, or anything legit you can prove, show, use to prove payroll to get into the program. And then remember, if you don't lay anybody off and maintain your payroll, you will have that loan converted into a grant, which is a great thing. So firstlibertyga.com is the website. Now, the president's doctor has begun prescribing the president hydroxychloroquine. Look, I got to be honest with you. There was a ton of media on this and a lot of clips. And I didn't ask Charlie, my producer, to cut any of that stuff up. There was some of it that I figured it was worth playing, including the president's own words. But by and large, the media discussion of this is in complete outrage over the president saying anything about it and recognizing he did it. And some of them, and I got to be real honest with you, part of me wonders if I'm real honest about it. Part of me wonders if the president really is actually taking hydroxychloroquine. And the reason I say it this way, and I realize his doctor has come out with a statement defending him, but it just, it sounded very much to me that it was just the president responding to the media and throwing something. And, you know, he does this sometimes. He throws stuff out like this to get the media off in a direction. He's learning now in the virus how to control the media response. It took the president a long time to be relearn how to steer the media in particular directions. And and now I think he's figured it out again with this hydroxychloroquine stuff.
People don't want to write the news, you know, but if you look, but he's the one that signed the application, the very important form. He signed it. Now, if he doesn't believe in it, why would he sign it? And a lot of good things have come out about the hydroxy. A lot of good things have come out. And you'd be surprised at how many people are taking it, especially the frontline workers, before you catch it. The frontline workers, many, many are taking it. I happen to be taking it. I happen to be taking it. I'm taking it, hydroxychloroquine. Right now, yeah. A couple of weeks ago, I started taking it. Because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories. And if it's not good, I'll tell you right, I'm not going to get hurt by it. It's been around for 40 years for malaria, for lupus, for other things. I take it. Frontline workers take it. A lot of doctors take it. Excuse me. A lot of doctors take it. I take it. Now, I hope to not be able to take it soon because, you know, I hope they come up with some answer. But I think people should be allowed to.
I just, listen, a lot of doctors say, I take it. listen. I don't know whether the president's taken it or not, but the media meltdown on this, there really was no reason for me to play a ton of audio of people. There's only one that I want to play, and this is to give you a sense of how the media is responding to this. This is CNN's treatment of the matter.
President Trump is taking questions at the White House. He just mentioned that he is taking hydroxychloroquine, the medication the president has promoted in the past as a potential treatment for coronavirus, though the FDA says that you shouldn't take it outside of a clinical trial of the hospital, and other studies have shown it doesn't work on coronavirus. The NIH has also issued warnings about using the drug for coronavirus patients. I want to bring in Jeremy Diamond, Joining me now, Jeremy, what exactly did President Trump say? He's taking hydroxychloroquine?
Jake, President Trump has repeatedly touted this drug, but he just announced moments ago for the first time that he himself has actually been taking hydroxychloroquine for the last week and a half. And the president says that he's taking it essentially as a prophylaxis to try and prevent getting the disease in the future, despite the fact that there is so far no substantive medical evidence to back up the fact that it works not only as a treatment, but all the more as a prophylaxis. Listen to what the president said just a few moments ago.
It's been around for 40 years for malaria, for lupus, for other things. I take it. Frontline workers take it. A lot of doctors take it. Excuse me. A lot of doctors take it. I take it.
And Jake, just we should note there, as you were saying at the top, no studies so far have shown that this is an effective treatment against coronavirus. In fact, there was a pretty significant study that showed that there was no effect on mortality or on the duration of a hospital patient's stay in the same way that we have seen with the drug remdesivir. But President Trump certainly putting his money where his mouth is with this. The question, though, Jake, is what effect is this going to have on the general population? You know, what are people going to think when they see that President Trump, President of the United States, is taking this drug, despite the fact that it does not have any proven medical benefits? Will Americans then want to take it themselves? That certainly is a big question here, Jake. And again, we do know that this drug has significant side effects, including potential heart issues for people. So certainly something that could be concerning.
Listen, the world is full of stupid people. We should acknowledge the world is full of stupid people. There's nothing mean. Say it is a statement of fact. Truth is not mean. Truth is truth. And the world is full of stupid people who, just as the president said that possibly we need to find ways to get disinfected into people. There were media stories out there that people, now admittedly, media exaggerated stories about people trying to ingest Clorox and the like. But there are stupid people out there. And so I understand the media concern about the president of the United States touting hydroxychloroquine when the studies are actually mixed. There are several studies out there that are small studies that show that hydroxychloroquine gives some benefit if taken early. There are other studies out there that show that there is no benefit regardless of when taken. The studies are mixed. The FDA right now suggests not taking it except in clinical situations, hospital situations. You know, I've got an agent in radio and he was in the hospital and they gave him hydroxychloroquine and he began to recover after they thought it was lights out for him. So he's a believer in hydroxychloroquine. And I know plenty of other people who are, but anecdote is not data and the data really is mixed. And it depends on who you are. It depends on when you get it. It depends on the dosage you get. There are all sorts of things there. And it can't prevent you from getting the virus. You're better off taking a zinc supplement than you are to take hydroxychloroquine if you don't want to get the virus. And by the way, the research on zinc is dubious as well, except it does appear to present as a milder case when you get viruses like the cold or the flu if you've got zinc in your system because of the way it impacts the virus absorption into cells. But here's the thing, y'all. There's no reason to dwell on this for a very long time. This is just the bottom line. For years, we have been told not to get between a woman and her doctor's decision to murder a baby. Who am I to get between a man and his doctor's decision to take a pill? If I can't get between the one, why should any of us be allowed to get between the other?
Well-connected and well-respected. It's Eric Erickson, live every weekday.
Two books by Ravi Zacharias that I recommend if you've never read, Jesus Among Other Gods and The Real Face of Atheism. Both of them are really good books if you want a basic understanding of his ministry to atheists and people in the East. He was just a brilliant evangelist. Now, a few more things on the president's hydroxychloroquine situation. The media, you know, the president, I think, has finally figured it out. One of the remarkable things about the president's inability, his superpower has always been, well, he's got two superpowers, this president. And they are remarkable abilities of this president. One is the ability to make other people reveal themselves to be as bad as they claim the president is. Meditate on that one for a moment. There are so many people who believe the president is, you know, there's no reason to even delve into it. They all the things they claim the president is. And the president has this unique superpower to make other people behave in whatever way they claim he behaves. The president has this superpower. It makes other people act in ways they claim the president acts. The other superpower that this president has or had is the ability to steer the national conversation in particular directions. And when this virus reared its head domestically, the president could not. I mean, think about all the news cycles we had last year. I mean, all the way up to killing Qasem Soleimani, in the beginning of this year with the Iran situation, we had all of these situations. And every week there was a new one. Every week it changed. Every week it shifted. And then the virus reared its head at the end of January, and it has been wall-to-wall nonstop virus, even overshadowing ultimately at the end impeachment, which, by the way, impeachment was another news cycle and just gone. We've been in this nonstop news cycle about the COVID-19 since really mid-February and really in March, and it hasn't shifted. It seems like every day that's all we can talk about. And I've been struggling, trying to find other things to talk about. And the president has had this unique gift. Sometimes he used it badly, where he could send the media off and wrap in all sorts of directions. If you will recall, 2 years ago at the State of the Union address, he did it again last year, but it was really 2 years ago where it was most powerful. The president had a family in the gallery at the State of the Union, and he began a lengthy dissertation on the ills of MS-13, the gang. And the media was forced finally to recognize that it was a real problem. And the president, actually, there was merit to his argument. And there were areas of this country where the gang was infiltrating and local authorities seemed helpless to the gang. And yep, there were issues where we needed to crack down on immigration. The president delivered that, I want to say, on a Monday night, maybe a Tuesday night. And by Thursday, went on a media attack, went on a Twitter tirade, an attack against someone in the media. And I can't remember who it was at the time. But the media had spent the entire week talking about MS-13. And they were going to, the Sunday shows were going to continue coverage of the president's State of the Union address because it had become such a big issue. The president had done a good job. The Democrats were on defense, and the president went on this Twitter tirade against someone in the media. And by Sunday, it was all gone. Now, States of the Union are largely meaningless anyway. And they always go away despite, you know, this was one of my frustrations when I was in the media, when I was on TV and on CNN. You would gear up all this coverage of whatever it was. You'd gear up this massive coverage of the State of the Union. And you would all go to New York or Washington. You would all be on a set. You'd have 20 people on CNN discussing the State of the Union. And within a week, we had all moved on. Everyone, oh, this is monumental. This is going to change the course of the president. This is going to change the course of everything. And then by the end of the week, you moved on to something else. And this president has stepped on himself repeatedly. But he has this unique superpower where he can redirect the media's trajectory in the stories they cover and how they cover them and what they're covering. And he has always been able to use that to his advantage when he uses it wisely. But of late, he's been unable to do that. Of late, the media has just fixated on the virus. They haven't shifted to other stories. And my gut feeling is that the president is not actually on hydroxychloroquine. He has just finally realized he can direct the media narrative in directions he wants to go. And proof of it is when I use a service that cuts up media audio clips. And like the top 10 clips were all about last night in the president talking about hydroxychloroquine. And I don't know that the story actually helps the president. I don't know that it actually does, but the fact that he is relearning how to direct the media's coverage of things, I think, is going to be a useful skill moving forward. The Obamagate situation, another one. How many? You've got Margaret Sullivan at the Washington Post writing, "We're going to turn this into Hillary's servers. Please, media, don't go down this road. It only helps Trump." Yes, you're right. It does help Trump. And yes, you're right. The media is going to go down that road. Why? Because the president has refigured out how to get the media to go in directions he wants. And that's going to help him and hurt Joe Biden in the run-up to the campaign. I found it. It's worth reading. Here, Margaret Sullivan. The media is helping Trump turn the bogus Obamagate into the 2020 version of Clinton's emails. It's becoming clear that journalists never fully reckoned with the mistakes of the 2016 campaign coverage. We know this because Donald Trump got elected. She doesn't write that, but that's what she means. We know this because they seem poised to repeat them. As you may recall, the news media, from Fox News to the New York Times and plenty of others across the political spectrum, managed to make the relative molehill of Hillary Clinton's dicey email practices into a daily obsession, roughly equal to the mountain of Donald Trump's financial and personal transgressions. Well, don't look now, but this is happening again before our eyes. Its name this time is Obamagate. That's a moniker that, in President Trump's outraged tweets, is rendered in capital letters. But let's not. This vaporous, apparently made-up offense, according to Trump, is the political crime of the century, and heck, last century too, because he claims that it makes the 1970s Watergate scandal look like child's play. As best as he's ever attempted to spell out, it supposedly involves a deep state conspiracy by the former president and his allies to undermine Trump by being informed of the identity of the private citizen having covert and legally questionable discussions with the Russian ambassador, a citizen who turns out to be Trump's national security advisor designate Michael Flynn. Despite the fact that this practice is legal and normal, the non-scandal around it is getting plenty of attention. On Chris Wallace's Sunday morning interview show, usually an island of relative sanity in the hyperpartisan pro-Trump world of Fox News, a bottom-of-the-screen cry on red, "Is Obamagate an effective campaign strategy?" And Trump water carrier Karl Rove was allowed to opine that there were some very serious questions that need to be answered. It does stink. Juan Williams, the network's designated left-leaning contrarian, tried to pour water on the nonsense. "There is no Obamagate," he said bluntly, declaring Trump's blather a smokescreen to distract from his disastrous handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Still, the conversation about the non-scandal went on for about 7 minutes on this popular show at the nation's most-watched cable network. Nor was it ignored on Meet the Press, where host Chuck Todd, while acknowledging the subject's ultimate emptiness, kicked around its potential political fallout for a while with White House correspondent Peter Alexander and others. And at CBS News, Catherine Herridge has been heavily hyping her updates on the non-story scoop, she declared on Twitter, to herald her story that acting director of national intelligence, Richard Grenell, had notified Congress about the great unmasking. CBS's hiring of Herridge from Fox News last year was sharply criticized by liberals, who recalled her persistent reporting on the Clinton email debacle and on debunked allegations that the former Secretary of State personally approved the diminishment of security at the Benghazi compound in Libya before the 2012 attack there. So let's just say that Obamagate is getting plenty of attention across the media spectrum, even if it's filtered through the lens of whether it will matter to swing state voters. But it does. So this is the ridiculous thing here with this Marcus Sullivan piece, and you're hearing more of this in the media, is that please don't talk about this thing that we don't like. But when the president of the United States starts talking about it, it's kind of hard to ignore it. Can we not agree on that? I mean, when the president of the United States is out there constantly doing this, the media has a hard time avoiding it. I mean, the media itself would look irresponsible if the president is talking about this. So they don't even if they're doing it to dismiss it. And that's her point. She doesn't want him to talk about it at all. And by the way, will it have an impact on swing state voters? I actually don't think it will. I actually don't think the Obamagate stuff matters to most people. In the same way, Hillary Clinton's email situation did not matter to most people. There were not a bunch of swing voters out there who said, you know what, I'm not going to vote for Hillary Clinton because of her incompetence on email or on Benghazi, frankly. Swing voters didn't vote for Hillary Clinton because they genuinely didn't like her in general. I mean, that's the thing I think a lot of Republicans miss. Listen, just because you hated Hillary Clinton and thought the email scandal was proof that she thought she was above the law doesn't mean that a bunch of swing voters who hated Hillary Clinton also voted against her for that. No, they voted against her because they didn't like her. They never liked her. And she was a terrible campaigner, and she didn't go to swing states that she needed to go to. It had nothing to do with the email server of Benghazi. And you see, you know, in the echo chamber of the right, where I live, people get spun up on this sort of stuff, and it doesn't really matter. You think it matters because you and all of your right-leaning friends all talk about it as if it matters. But you were never going to vote for Hillary Clinton anyway. In the same way, on the left, hydroxychloroquine doesn't matter. On the left right now, they're spun up about hydroxychloroquine and the president taking hydroxychloroquine. And the president shouldn't take hydroxychloroquine. And he's going to make stupid people take hydroxychloroquine. And people on the left, this is a grave concern to them. They deeply care about this issue. But no swing voter cares about the president and his doctor. I mean, again, after all, for years we've been told you can't come between a woman and her doctor's decision to murder a child. You can't come between a man and his doctor's decision to take a pill. You just can't. And swing voters couldn't care less. You got to be able to navigate through the echo chamber to what actually is reality. And on the right, you're convinced that Obamagate matters. It doesn't. On the left, you're convinced hydroxychloroquine matters. It doesn't. What matters is swing voters. And right now, what matters to swing voters is the virus and the economic recovery. And if the president can move us beyond the virus to economic recovery, that matters, which is why so many people on the left are just adamantly convinced that the president should not be allowed to do this, that the president should not be allowed to reopen the country. By the way, there's a phenomenon. I wrote about this morning. And this is important. The president of the United States this morning, not the president of the United States. I wrote about this morning with the president and everything else that's going on out there. The president of the United States and governors in the South are invested in the idea of reopening the government. Brian Kemp yesterday had a call with the president where the president of the United States commended him on reopening. And this comes on the heels of the president. Remember, where's the, I saved the audio just so we can hear it one more time.
I told the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, that I disagree strongly with his decision to open certain facilities which are in violation of the phase one guidelines for the incredible people of Georgia. They're incredible people. I love those people. They're great. They've been strong, resolute. But at the same time, he must do what he thinks is right. I want him to do what he thinks is right. But I disagree with him on what he's doing. But I want to let the governors do. Now, if I see something totally egregious, totally out of line, I'll do. But I think spas and beauty salons and tattoo parlors and barbershops in phase one, we're going to have phase two very soon, is just too soon. I think it's too soon.
That was what the president said then. And now he is commending Governor Kemp for reopening. And you know what's happening? When this virus first started, if you're a regular listener to this program, back in January and February, I was telling people that you needed to go on and stock up. Take this seriously. That maybe it wouldn't come here, but if it did come here, it was going to be problematic, and you needed to take care. You needed to stock up. You know, it's one reason. So Mrs. Griffin's barbecue sauce sponsors the program, and I'm glad to have them be a sponsor. They're a barbecue sauce. You know, you still go to the grocery store. Like I go to Publix, and you have a hard time finding ketchup and mayonnaise. You can find Mrs. Griffin's barbecue sauce because it's local and it's delicious. Now, I will tell you, yesterday I made my homemade barbecue sauce. that I rarely ever make these days, and it's fantastic. But if I didn't have it, I would be using Mrs. Griffin's, and you should too. I made pulled pork yesterday, and I've been wanting it. I call it my brisket sauce. I normally only make it for brisket, but it's really good. I put the, you should follow me on Instagram at EW Erickson on Instagram, and you can see my recipe. Some of you won't like it, but it's not a vinegar. It's not really even mustard. It's a sweet citrusy sauce, and then you put cayenne in and it gets spicy in any event. Thank you to Mrs. Griffin's for your sponsorship as well. An excellent barbecue sauce that you can get at the grocery store, and it's stocked on the shelves at the grocery store, unlike so many other products. Why? Because they're local here in Georgia. They're a local business, and they're stocking the shelves themselves. Tell about the grocery stores. And the governor wants to reopen the economy now here in Georgia and start letting people get back out of their house and resume their lives and let the toilet paper flow back onto the shelves of the grocery stores. And the president is now commending him. And there's this thing happening. There are truthers on the left that have come out. The truthers on the left now believe that Brian Kemp is lying about the data. Over the weekend in Atlanta, there was a spike of 231 COVID-19 cases that disappeared. Where did it go? The left became convinced that Brian Kemp is lying about the data. Nope. Here's what happens. The state has now begun testing some people who thought they had COVID-19, but never got tested originally. So they no longer have it, and they're being given the antibody test. The antibody test may or may not be accurate, but it returned positives, and the testing facility that logged the data put it in the wrong column. They put it in the column of test positive COVID-19 as opposed to antibody test positive. And those are different things because we're still sorting out whether or not the antibody test is actually accurate, and the people who have it actually don't currently have it. So they're only in the positive test, they're only putting in people who test positive for coronavirus right now. And so when they realized the mistake, they took those 231 case out, and it dropped the number. And the lesson, conspiracy! Brian Kemp's rigging the numbers to make it look better than it is. It's really worse than this by 231. In Florida, the same thing happened. The woman in charge of the data in Florida has been reassigned. She created a website that healthcare professionals around the nation have loved. The Dr. Birx of the White House has praised the design of the state of Florida website. There's only a problem. It kept breaking and the data kept screwing up. And so the woman developed this website. Everyone praised it, but it kept screwing up. So they've reassigned her. So the media is now doing the story. Let me cover the story for you. This is crazy. Florida Today has the story. As Florida reopens, COVID-19 data chief gets sidelined and researchers cry foul. Late last Friday, the architect and manager of Florida's COVID-19 dashboard, praised by the White House officials for its accessibility, announced she had been removed from her post, causing outcry from independent researchers now worried about government censorship. The dashboard had been a one-stop shop for researchers, the media, and the public to access and download tables of COVID-19 cases, testing, and death data to analyze freely. It's been widely hailed as a shining example of transparency and accessibility. But over the last few weeks, it has crashed and gone offline. Data has gone missing without explanation, and access to the underlying data sheets has become increasingly difficult. So last week, the woman who set it up was removed after the problem started. And so now researchers all on the left are crying foul. Let me read you, buried at the bottom of this story, there is one key sentence. One key sentence buried. It's not even at the bottom. It's buried in about three quarters of the way down. Data access, since she was fired or reassigned, data access has not worsened further yet. But researchers are sounding the alarm. So the timeline. Woman creates website. Website is highly praised. Website begins breaking all the time. Data goes missing. She gets reassigned after all of this starts happening. The data access hasn't worsened since she left. And now everyone else is like, oh, the Florida must be engaged in a conspiracy. Notice that the media is fundamentally, they were fundamentally invested, along with a lot of conservatives, myself included, on pushing back on conservatives who said the data was wrong. There were so many conservatives who were lying about that. It's just the flu. How many times have you heard it's just the flu? I'm sorry. Has the flu killed 80,000 people in 10 weeks ever? No. And so there are those of you out there yelling at me right now, but the data's all wrong. How many deaths are fraudulent? No one can give me an answer on this. How many of the 85,000 people who have died are wrong? How many shouldn't have been on the list? No one can provide. Is it 40,000? Well, if it's 40,000, you know what? That leaves 45,000 people who've died in 10 weeks of this virus, which still makes it worse than the flu. Nobody can give me the accurate data. I can give you the data. I just can't make you believe it. But the right engaged in these conspiracy theories. People on the right, myself included, push back on it. Well, now the left is creating these conspiracy theories that Brian Kemp and Ron DeSantis are rigging the data as they reopen the states. They're downplaying the data. They're changing the data. And you know what's so frustrating about it is that members of the media who were willing to push back on conservatives aren't willing to do it on the left because many in the media actually agree. Many people in the media actually believe that Brian Kemp and Ron DeSantis are painting rosy scenarios and they can't admit it because there's no evidence of it, but they believe it, so they're not willing to push back on the left. If you're not willing to push back on left-wing data truthers like you were right-wing data truthers, you're not an intellectually honest person. You've got to be willing to push back on that. But they're not. So it's left up to people like me. And it's really frustrating. For 2 months, I and a bunch of others were pushing back on right-wing data truthers who were lying about the data, claiming it was fraudulent, claiming it was fake, claiming it was exaggerated. And now the left is doing the same, that the data is fraudulent, the data is fake, the data is exaggerated, and it's not. The data is the data. I can lead you to it. I can't make you take it. But the media that was so invested in pushing back on people on the right isn't willing to invest in people pushing back on the left. Part of that is members of the media really do believe the virus is going to rebound and a reopening is dangerous. But part of it, and a growing part of it, is that so many members of the media have institutionally invested in the idea that Donald Trump is bad, Brian Kemp is bad, Ron DeSantis is bad, and they all need to be beat, that they can't afford to give them any credit. And they can't afford to allow them to reopen their states. Because if their states reopen and the economy rebounds, that's going to help the president. And above all else, the media views the president as more dangerous than the virus, and he must be stopped more than the virus. And if the president must be stopped more than the virus, then the president can't be given any credit for an economic rebound. And the best way to stop the president for getting any credit for an economic rebound is to keep you sheltered in place by ignoring the good news and focusing on the bad news.
I really do like his opinion on things.
Eric Erickson, the information you need and the truth you demand.
He tells it like it is.
Live every weekday.
Hello there. It is Eric Erickson here. My mom texts me that I need to slow down, so I will slow down. Sometimes I get excited. The news is very excitable these days. Joe Biden. Oh my goodness. This plays into the president's hands. Joe Biden on Tuesday released a 3-page summary of his medical history in which his doctors declared he is a healthy, vigorous 77-year-old, fully capable of taking on the role of president. Biden, who has taken to challenging voters and reporters to push up contests and wrestling matches to demonstrate his physical vigor, has faced persistent questions during the campaign about his age and his mental acuity, most prominently from President Trump. The summary indicates that Biden has been treated for several conditions, including an irregular heartbeat, gastroesophageal reflux, and seasonal allergies. It was written by Kevin O'Connor, who is director of executive medicine at the George Washington Medical Faculty Associates and was Biden's physician when he was vice president. Wait. Where is it? Where is it? Hang on. It appears that they did not test his cognitive functions. The only test, this is Olshansky. Who is Olshansky? Stuart Olshansky, a professor of public health at the University of Illinois Chicago, who analyzes the longevity of presidents, said that Biden's workout regime was a positive sign. The most important thing that I saw on there, once you get into your 70s, the one signal that is the strongest of all that tells you someone is exceptional is their ability to work out on a regular basis. Working out at least 5 days a week for someone his age, if that's indeed true, is remarkable. The only test that hasn't been done is the cognitive functioning test, Olshansky added. But the fact that he's on the campaign trail and meeting a rigorous travel and meeting schedule probably would suffice as a replacement for the formal test for cognitive function. He said the cognitive tests are typically not required unless problems are detected. Have you not paid attention to Biden on the campaign trail? Have you not paid attention to this man? He doesn't know where he is. I mean, you tell Biden he's on the campaign trail and he asks, is it the traditional with Worcestershire or is it the one with the M&Ms? Not trail mix, sir. Campaign trail. Oh, Biden has no idea. I mean, the man does not know. Listen, say what you, Joe Biden, very nice guy, not trying to be insulting here, but good gracious, the Joe Biden of 2020 is not the Joe Biden of 2016. The Donald Trump of 2020 is the exact same Donald Trump that existed 4 years ago. The Joe Biden of today is not the Joe Biden of 4 years ago, and only the Democrats try not to pay attention to that. Joe Biden being on the campaign trail is not a test of his cognitive function because he doesn't even know he's on the campaign trail in order to be able to test it.